Welcome to the In Context War Report, produced by MDR Productions, Inc. The In Context War Report is broadcast at noon on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. Our website is incontextreport.com. I'm your host, Ken McDermott Rowe, and I'm joined by the War Report's military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe. And in the War Report, we examine recent developments in war and geopolitics around the world and see how these events affect global stability and U.S. national security. Now, Marchand, I'd like to first start with a review of the global war situation, starting with Syria. For 2 years, you've been making the case that the United States needs to join forces with the Russians to fight the jihadists. Somebody apparently was listening. Earlier this month, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov announced that they had agreed to cooperate in the fight against the Islamic State and other jihadists in Syria. Recent events seem to have placed this agreement in jeopardy, but the deal called for, one, the establishment of a joint implementation center to coordinate Russian and U.S. military operations, two, coordination of airstrikes, three, the cessation of hostilities in certain areas, including Aleppo, to allow humanitarian access and spare civilians. In addition, Russia said that Syria, its ally, would abide by the agreement. Unfortunately, a few days after the agreement was made, it was placed in jeopardy when the U.S. bombed a Syrian base in eastern Syria, besieged by rebels. The U.S. bombing killed 62 Syrian soldiers and wounded over 100. The rebels took advantage of the bombing to advance on the Syrian defenders. The United States said that the bombing was an accident. However, recently, Assad, the leader of Syria, said that he thought the United States intentionally bombed the Syrian base. Marchand, could this have been a mistake? And if it was not a mistake, why would the United States have done it? And Marchand is joining us due to his location necessarily by cell phone, so we apologize for any degradation in the quality of his communication.
It is entirely plausible that this airstrike was an accident. I mean, these sort of things have happened before, and they do happen in the fog of war. But it is also plausible that some of our ne'er-do-well allies may have found themselves surrounded by the Syrian army, and we decided we couldn't afford to lose a whole contingent of them. We may never actually know the full truth, but the fact is that an airstrike of this nature did jeopardize the cooperation agreement with the Russians, but also it demonstrated, I think in a lot of ways it emphasized, the fact that we are using doublespeak. And the reason why I say that is because, on the one hand, we're saying, okay, let's cooperate with the Russians to fight ISIS, but we're still arming jihadists to fight against the Syrian government and to fight against Russian troops. So it's a little bizarre. The best analogy would be is if, on the one hand, we're supporting the Russians in their fight against the Nazis, while at the same time supplying the Japanese to go fight the Russians. This emphasizes, in the minds of, I'm sure, the Russian leadership and the Syrian leadership, whether the strike was intentional or not really almost doesn't matter. In their mind, it emphasizes the fact that we are not sincere about keeping this agreement with the Russians. And indeed, a good example of this has been the calls for a no-fly zone, which really been pushed hard by Hillary Clinton. But on September 23rd, it was reported in Russia Today, of all places, that General Dunford and Secretary of Defense Ash Carter will testify before the Senate Armed Services Committee, stated that a no-fly zone must be implemented over Syria, that the only aircraft exempt from this no-fly zone would be the U.S. aircraft, U.S. military aircraft, and that, of course, this would probably result in a confrontation with the Russian and the Syrian government. Well, obviously, you tell the Syrian Air Force and the Russian Air Force not to fly in their own war zone, it's going to result in a confrontation. But this is this demonstrates that there is a tremendous amount of doublespeak going on.
Well, there's a conflict, Marchand, a basic conflict in objectives here on the United States' part. Yes, we don't like the Islamic State, but on the other hand, as we've covered this war since its inception 5 years ago, and the objective of this war, which was incited by the United States, the so-called insurgency movement, was to overthrow the Assad government so that Russia would be deprived of a key regional ally, which provides it with access to the Mediterranean for the Russian fleet through the Syrian port of Tartus. And as we covered back 5 years ago, Ambassador Robert Ford of the United States, appointed by President Obama, was meeting with opposition groups. Shortly thereafter, Debka File, the Israeli newsletter, reported that U.S. surrogates, Qatar and Saudi Arabia, were bringing in jihadist fighters from Libya, people that we had used to help overthrow Gaddafi, and that they were committing acts of terrorism within Syria to destabilize the government and eventually bring about the overthrow of the Syrian government, replaced presumably with a pro-U.S. government. Now, I think our dilemma is the United States still hasn't let go of its dream of overthrowing the Syrian government and replacing it with the pro-U.S. government, as it did, for example, in the Ukraine in 2014. These two objectives really aren't consistent, because how do you discriminate between the good rebels who want to overthrow Assad, who that we like, and the bad rebels who are allied with the Islamic State? It's really not very practical.
Not at all. The strategy in Syria right now makes about as much sense as supporting the Soviet Union's fight against Nazi Germany while still backing the Japanese to go fight the Soviets. It's irrational, because at the end of the day, the jihadists that we're sponsoring, and I make no mistake, the people that we've been arming quite frequently, and this is public knowledge, the people we have been arming frequently switch sides and join either al-Qaeda in Syria, Jabhat al-Nusra, or they go and join ISIS, which is why ISIS has ended up, one of the reasons, they've ended up with a lot of American weapons.
And of course, al-Nusra had just recently brought down a Russian aircraft, killing some Russians.
Exactly. And it's entirely possible that that may have been a U.S.-supplied Stinger. Now, of course, we probably didn't supply it directly to al-Nusra, but my guess is we supplied it to a group of ne'er-do-well allies who decided, well, screw this, I'm going to buy my way out of this war by selling this. Geez, we'd probably get a pretty penny for a, you know, American-made Stinger missile, I'm certain, and, you know, buy your way out of the war zone. And that we have had this issue before. When there was a group of rebels that we had trained in Jordan, there were approximately 60 of them, and within 24 hours of entering Syria, most of them were either captured or defected to the jihadists. And so it's not surprising that these very sophisticated weapons are now starting to turn up in the hands of al-Nusra, and maybe they will be turning up in the hands of ISIS.
Meanwhile, Marshad, what's going on in the war on the ground? What's happening specifically in Aleppo, the largest city in Syria, a large part of which has been taken over by Islamic State jihadists?
Well, on September 23rd, it was reported that Russian planes had begun bombing Aleppo, and the Syrian army has begun its assault on the city. And, of course, that was reported in USA Today. It's been reported in The Independent as of September 24th that an intense wave of bombings has begun on Aleppo, and the Syrian army is preparing or has begun to invade the city with ground troops. Now, one of the things that I think the United States was hoping to achieve, because Aleppo is one of the very intensely contested cities, but it's also a crucial economic and cultural center to Syria. Regaining control of Aleppo would be the equivalent of retaking New York if the United States were to be invaded. It is a historically significant city, and it is a economically significant city. So one of the things I believe that the United States was hoping to achieve during the ceasefire was an opportunity for the rebels to kind of regroup, reorganize, and then prepare to repel the Syrian army, which may be one of the reasons why the Russians decided, oh, to heck with it, we're going to take the city anyway. Because, again, this is where there's that total lack of trust between the United States and Russia. Clearly, our policy and that of the Russians are in conflict, not in cooperation. So really, what incentive do the Russians have to play ball when it comes to the ceasefire? If they have an opportunity to retake Aleppo from the jihadists that control it, why would they ignore that opportunity? And certainly, the Syrian army is now reinvigorated. They're pushing into the city, supported by Russian airstrikes. It's very feasible they will retake the city.
And there'll be a lot of casualties, too, Marshad, because we covered urban warfare in great detail in a previous show, which is archived at our website, incontextreport.com. And there's no way that you can conduct urban warfare against an insurgent group and not do a lot of damage and end up killing a lot of people. Am I correct?
Yes. It's going to be a high body count on all sides. Generally speaking, that's the nature of urban war. It's very bloody. It's house to house, room to room, floor to floor. During the Battle of Stalingrad, famously, it was noted that the Germans would control the third floor, the Russians would be on the fourth floor, and Germans on the fifth floor, you know? And they'd be fighting floor to floor and room to room. It is inherently bloody. And one of the reasons why the Russians were very hesitant, it appeared, about the idea of the humanitarian corridor was that these corridors could also be used to resupply the rebels. Because, let's face it, nobody fights fair anymore. Realistically speaking, would it be beyond the rebels to seize those medical supplies instead of using them for the women and children, using them for their own soldiers? Of course they're going to do that. So a key to winning an urban conflict, an urban battle like this, is to completely cut the city off. Because one of the things that kept Stalingrad alive and fighting was the fact that they were able to continue to be resupplied from the opposite side of the Volga by the Red Army. On the other hand, when you look at Berlin, for example, the Battle of Berlin, the Russians had Berlin surrounded. So it was only a matter of time before, without an ability to get reinforcements, without an ability to resupply, to evacuate your wounded, eventually the city was going to fall. Granted, the Russians lost hundreds of thousands of men in the fight for Berlin, but they still took the city eventually. And I think that's the key with Aleppo. If the Russians and the Syrian army completely cuts off the city, it will eventually fall. And people will lose their will to fight eventually, because if the city is being starved out, they can't get supplies in, they can't get water in, they can't get food in. And I'm not justifying this, but it is a fact of war. If they cannot get the necessary supplies in, the fighters just seeing their families dying, they're going to lose the will to fight. And they may decide to cut an amiable deal with the Russians is better than watching their own family starve to death.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and we've been talking about the war in Syria as part of our global roundup. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1 p.m. Now, Marshawn, I want to also mention an area of Russian-U.S. confrontation. On September 7th, U.S. P-8 Poseidon surveillance planes with transponders turned off were intercepted by Russian Su-27 fighters as they approached the Russian border from the Black Sea. U.S. officials said that a Russian Su-27 came within about 3 meters of a U.S. plane, and the standoff lasted for about 19 minutes. What does it mean that the transponders of the U.S. planes were turned off?
Well, the purpose of the transponders, as I understand it, is to notify to identify your aircraft and to notify particularly civilian aircraft and civilian aircraft air traffic controllers that you are in their path of flight, because you constantly have civilian aircraft flying in all directions, and they all have pre-approved flight plans, and they're all talking to each other, and they're all talking to the various traffic controllers in the areas they're flying through. Military aircraft usually have to publish a similar kind of flight plan and keep transponders on so as to notify the traffic controllers and notify the civilian aircraft in the area so they don't crash into each other. As surprising as it might be for most people, what keeps aircraft from crashing into each other is an intense level of organization, plus these little technological advances. Well, by turning off the transponders, it's dangerous to civilian aircraft because now they don't know we're there. But also, it's a way of trying to sneak your aircraft a little bit closer. The Russians have done this before. They've sent in bombers or fighter jets with their transponders turned off into NATO airspace, into even U.S. airspace, to kind of gauge our reaction. And what this demonstrates is, because eventually it will be detected by military aircraft, it will just be shown as an unidentified aircraft, and then, of course, we launch and respond, or the Russians launch and respond, but it does show the uptick in hostilities.
And Marshawn, the Russians claim that the U.S. planes were spying on a massive Russian military drill, which was conducted earlier in September near the Ukraine. I'd like to talk a little bit about that drill, which took place on Crimea's Black Sea coast, in which the Russian forces were repelling a mock amphibious invasion.
One of the things that's really interesting when you look at the Russian drills was that it wasn't just Crimea. It was you had 40,000 troops that were brought into Crimea, but it also consisted of troops deployed, particularly motorized infantry divisions, deployed along the Russian border with Ukraine, as well as 2 separate tanks, guards, armies. So this totaling ballpark, about 120,000 Russian troops were mobilized for this exercise. The other thing that's interesting is that the Russians deployed a whole host of new technology to this exercise. And, you know, of course, a lot of this was technology that we'd seen before, that we knew about, But what's really interesting is the fact that this demonstrates the Russians are putting their latest hardware on the front lines. The fact that they deployed the Mi-8, which is a twin-turbine helicopter, which has a top speed of 260 kilometers per hour, is an incredibly fast gunship. It is the latest the Russians have produced, and now it's deployed to the front lines. Because one thing to see aircraft and this hardware deployed in an air show or deployed to Central Siberia for exercise, but when this aircraft is right on the front lines, it's a demonstration of force. The other thing, too, is the deployment of the S-400 surface-to-air missile systems. Those were deployed to Crimea as well as areas bordering Ukraine. Now, one of the things that's really interesting is the S-400 is the latest Russian surface-to-air missile system. We aren't entirely certain of its capability because it hasn't been used in combat yet. What we do know is it has been estimated by certain naval officers speaking off the record that it may be capable of shooting down our stealth aircraft, which would be an incredible threat. And in fact, the range of the S-400 is incredible because by deploying a handful in Crimea and along the border with eastern Ukraine, it gives, in theory, the Russians total air dominance of almost all of Ukraine and almost all of the Black Sea. So the deployment of this missile could, in many ways, in the event of a war, negate a lot of our air power. Because one of the things I would like to mention to our listeners is the 1973 war fought between Israel and Egypt. And during the war, the Egyptian Air Force still had not recovered from the Six-Day War in 1967, when the Egyptian Air Force had been pulverized. So instead of trying to go toe-to-toe with the Israelis, matching them plane for plane, what the Egyptians did is they bought a whole host of surface-to-air missile systems, the latest they could get from the Soviet Union, and they deployed those along the Israeli border in the Sinai. And when the Egyptians invaded the Sinai, they used these missile systems to shoot down the Israeli aircraft and prevent the Israelis from bringing in close air support, which is why the Egyptians met with early successes during the war. So this principle can allow a country to establish air dominance without ever having to risk their own aircraft. The fact that the Russians have deployed this new system, again, demonstrates an intent to use. This isn't just something that's being deployed in a military exercise in Siberia. This demonstrates an intent to use it. Whether they truly intend to use it, who can say? But the fact is it demonstrates a show of force, intent to use their most sophisticated hardware.
Now, Marchand, the exercise was to simulate an invasion of the Crimea, presumably by NATO. Were the skills that were being demonstrated ones that would be used in a larger war in Ukraine or throughout Eastern Europe?
Absolutely, absolutely, because every strategy in theory is designed for a defensive war. Even the Schlieffen Plan, which was Germany's plan implemented during World War I, was in theory a defensive plan. You know, in the event Germany is attacked on both sides, we will go on the offensive. Well, when the Russians say it's the defense of Crimea, the tactics they were employing could very easily be used in offensive operations, namely the use of the surface-to-air missiles, the close air support provided by the attack helicopters, and then the heavy use of paratroopers. The Russians dropping mass landings of paratroopers on the ground while utilizing napalm as well, again, demonstrates a very close coordination between the Russian Air Force and, of course, the Russian airborne units. And one of the things that's very crucial to remember is the Russian airborne units, they are the elite of the Russian army, but the Russians put a lot of emphasis on their airborne units. The idea that the Russians have, the Russian strategy is very interesting. I read years ago a translation of a KGB field manual from, I guess it was written in the 1980s. And the initial Russian strategy in the event of war with NATO was not simply to send tanks through the Fold the Gap and invade West Germany, but rather it was to utilize paratroopers and special forces to take our airfields, and more importantly, to kill our pilots. That was the number one strategy. Parachute in, enter the barracks in the middle of the night and kill our pilots, because the planes are worthless without the pilots. And that was actually a fear that the British Ministry of Defense has recently expressed regarding the F-35. One of the things that they're afraid of is that in the event of war, the Russians would just simply shoot their pilots in the barracks and the planes are worthless. So the heavy use of paratroopers is a strategy that has been on the books in Russian doctrine since the Cold War, and something, again, we are woefully lacking in at this stage.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott, your host, and I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator. And we've been talking most recently about the Russian-U.S. confrontation in Ukraine. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to 1, and you can download this or prior editions of the War Report to your computer or mobile device from our website, incontextreport.com, or go to WPKN and click on Podcasts in the upper left-hand corner. Now, Marshawn, in our review of global developments, I'd like to turn to Asia. This month, President Obama made his last official trip to Asia. While the Obama administration has in recent years talked of a military pivot to the Pacific, the Chinese do not seem very impressed. When President Obama arrived at the airport in China, the Chinese officials failed to provide a portable staircase for Mr. Obama to disembark from the upper door of Air Force One, as befits the head of state. Instead, the president emerged from a small staircase in the belly of the aircraft. Many saw this as a deliberate sign of disrespect by the Chinese to the United States. Marshawn, what do you think?
I absolutely think it was a demonstration by the Chinese. China, for the longest time, has, in a way, had to kowtow to the West. You know, not just because they sell us a lot of stuff, but mostly because, militarily speaking, China was backwards. Up until the 1990s, when during the first Gulf War, China saw the military might of the United States and went, oh my gosh, we got to play catch-up. China, since then, of course, has had to still continue to kowtow to the United States in many ways because China was not ready to confront the United States. But now what we're seeing with the seizure of the South China Sea and the seizure of those Japanese islands, China has come into its own. And really, China is, in a way, saying that they are done kowtowing. They are done playing second fiddle to the United States. And part of the reason is because the Chinese are demonstrating that they, in a way, don't need us anymore. Now, we like to think that, well, we buy a lot of their stuff, so they'll always need us. Well, no, that's why they're seizing the South China Sea, because there's a lot of oil and natural gas there. But fundamentally, what the Chinese are trying to show is they are not dependent on the West. They do not need the West, particularly the United States. And a lot of this is, you have to remember that since the Opium Wars in the 1840s, China has always been, in many ways, under the heel of the West. And since the days of the Cold War, been second to the United States. Now, China is emerging into its own, and in the most aggressive and direct way possible, saying to the United States that not only do we no longer respect you, but now we will no longer be second to you, we will no longer be subservient to you. You will respect us as a superpower. You will view us as your equal. And I think that's what, at least what I was reading from this this recent incident.
And of course, Marshawn, as we've been reporting for some time now, there's a growing conflict between China, the United States, and China's neighbors in the South China Sea. And recent satellite photos show that China appears to have built reinforced aircraft hangars on three reefs in the South China Sea islands. The new hangars have room for any fighter jet in the Chinese Air Force. And just a couple of months ago, an international court in The Hague ruled against China's claim to most of the South China Sea. The South China Sea is very strategically important because $5 trillion in shipborne trade passes through the South China Sea every year, and there are also believed to be great oil and gas reserves under its waters. The dispute over control involves the United States, of course, which is a great Pacific power since the Spanish-American War in 1898. It also includes the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Taiwan, and Brunei, who have overlapping claims to parts of the South China Sea. Now, speaking of the Philippines, to add further insult, President Obama was called the son of a female dog on this trip by President Duterte of the Philippines at a summit in Asia. The Filipino president was reacting to U.S. criticism of his human rights abuses in his war on drug traffickers. He said that the Philippines was not a vassal state of the United States. So this is how our friends talk about us now, huh?
Well, exactly. And a lot of this, again, is because they're not, on the one hand, they're not intimidated by us, but also because, if you will, the scales have fallen from the eyes of a lot of these nations. You know, at the end of the Cold War, one of the things was, I mean, of course, democracy, we will stand for human rights, human decency, and we will support our allies, and don't worry, you will never need to fear your enemies because the United States will always be there to protect you. Well, what ended up happening instead, if you look at particularly a lot of the countries of the former Soviet bloc, is they, in a way, they feel betrayed by the, if you will, the dream of liberation from communism and the dream of the end of the Cold War, because a lot of these countries have not prospered. In the case of the Philippines, which the Philippines was an ally, but during the Cold War and ever since, they've been fighting a communist insurgency, they've been fighting an Islamic insurgency, and they've also been dealing with incredible drug problems. So now President Obama steps in and says, no, listen, you got to fight this war the way we tell you to. And President Duterte came to power because he said, I will drop the iron fist. I will destroy the drug dealers. And in fact, he famously said the day he was elected, he opened his shirt and he said, I'm coming for you. If you want to, shoot me now because I'm coming for you. I mean, this was clearly a man who is staunchly nationalistic and is determined at any price to rid the country of drug lords, rid the country of the communists, and rid the country of Islamic terrorists. Now, on the one hand, you have somebody like Obama saying, no, you have to play nice, you have to play by the rules. Well, countries like the Philippines are starting to realize, no, we don't have to do. We can find a Filipino answer to this problem. Because clearly, what the United States has been telling us what to do for the last umpteen years has not been working. So we will find our answer, our way. We do not have to listen to you. And part of the problem is that we, as the United States, tend to, particularly under this administration, stand with a holier-than-thou. No, we have the enlightened path. You must follow our way. And because we're not militarily strong anymore, these countries don't feel like they have to listen to us, you know, looking down our noses at them. They can stand up for themselves and they can make their own decisions. Because at the end of the day, we need the Philippines. We need them a lot, especially to stand up against China. You know, heaven forbid the Filipinos decide to be friends with the Chinese. We're in real trouble then. And President Duterte knows this. So his making a stand is almost a way of the third world, the traditionally, you know, the traditional third world saying, no, we are doing things our way. You either like it or we'll side with the people you don't like.
And while I think we can still safely regard the Philippines as an ally, that is to say the United States can safely regard the Philippines as an ally, it is the United States is deploying troops there. We've got a situation in another part of Asia which is scary, and that is North Korea. North Korea claims to have successfully detonated a nuclear warhead recently that could be mounted on ballistic missiles. They said that it would enable North Korea to produce a variety of smaller, lighter, and diversified nuclear warheads of high strike power. The nuclear bomb in the test was its fifth in the last 10 years. At 10 kilotons, this bomb was two-thirds the size of the bomb dropped by the United States on Hiroshima in 1945. The United States, of course, is concerned about the North Korean threat to our Pacific allies, Japan and South Korea, and plans deployment of the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, an anti-missile system in South Korea. Marshawn, how big a threat does North Korea pose to South Korea and Japan?
Well, it poses a tremendous threat, because deploying the THAAD is a wonderful idea, but let's not forget that the capital city, Seoul, and the millions of people who live there are within artillery range of the North Korean army. Now, the reason why North Korea traditionally was always willing to play ball, in the end, they'll be loud, they'll be obnoxious, but they were willing to talk to us, was because, particularly after the 2003 invasion of Iraq, they knew we had the ability to field a very large army with incredible firepower and advanced technology. And that was enough to kind of keep the North Koreans in many ways in check. But now that our military has been so gutted, there was an article I read not that long ago in Newsweek which said that we were approximately 800 pilots short. The Marine Corps is cannibalizing parts for its aircraft, and we only have one armored division, and our brigade combat teams are shrinking by the day. The North Koreans know that we do not have the capability of deploying large numbers of troops. So on the one hand, they have the nuclear device as a deterrent. If they were to invade South Korea, there's 24,000 American soldiers that are in the line of fire, but they know it would be very difficult for us to deploy large amounts of troops. And even then, particularly under this administration, they know we'd be much more hesitant in many ways to intervene directly if we know they have atomic bombs. So while I'm inclined to believe that the North Koreans, or at least I'd like to believe, the North Koreans would be nuts enough to actually launch an atomic bomb on Seoul, in the end, I think they view the atomic bomb as a way to operate with impunity. as a way, as a deterrent, because a miniaturized atomic bomb doesn't necessarily just need to be attached to a warhead and launched across the Pacific at Hawaii. Realistically speaking, they could hide a small nuclear device on board a shipping container, send it to San Francisco Bay, and knock it and kill 100,000 people. And they know that this is a significant threat to the United States. So I think in their mind, this means that they have a deterrent that can allow them, if they so choose, to attack their neighbors and put the United States in a very awkward defensive position.
Again, this really illustrates a point we've been trying to make for years now, which is the United States' confrontation with Russia, a confrontation which really began immediately at the end of the Cold War, where we rushed to fill the vacuum by the collapse of the Soviet Union, by the immediate expansion of NATO, which has gone from 14 to 28 countries, incorporating former Soviet republics, incorporating its allies in the Warsaw Pact, bringing NATO's army right up to the border of Russia, creating a very bad situation with the Russians. It is not really helping U.S. national security. All of it's doing is creating tension and the prospect of a disastrous war with Russia. It's been our position on the show is that it's a very foolish policy, that we should be seeking common ground with the Russians and fighting our common enemy, the Islamic jihadists, and also refocusing our energies into the real threat to U.S. national security, a much more important one, which is in the Pacific with China and with North Korea.
And that is why I always have consistently emphasized the key to our security is going to be a strong military, a strong foreign policy, but also good relations with the Russians. Because at the end of the day, the Chinese, as badly as they want territory, as badly as they want to seize the Pacific, as badly as the North Koreans want to attack their neighbors, in the end, the Chinese will not move so long as the Russians are in our camp. And that's not far beyond the realm of possibility, because at the end of the day, we have a lot more in common with the Russians than we do with the Chinese. China, is, and I've said this many times before, is an atheistic communist state. North Korea is a militantly atheistic pseudo-Stalinist state. Russia is a dictatorship, but it's a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, nominally capitalist state. It is Western at the end of the day. And Russia historically has always looked, you go back to Peter the Great, Russia has always looked towards the West. Russia is always going to emulate the West. And in the end, what do Russians want? More than anything, they want security on their borders. They want to have a buffer zone with the West. Also, they want what every other people on the planet wants: flat screen TVs and American cars. So if we can guarantee Russian security, they will in turn guarantee our security. That's the whole reason why we never invaded the Soviet bloc. We knew, Truman knew, that keeping that balance with the Soviet Union was the key to peace. And that doctrine stayed throughout the Cold War. Whereas on the other hand, what we are doing now, pushing directly onto the Russian borders, pushing directly into what has historically been the Russian sphere of influence, Ukraine, Georgia, and moving missile systems into places like Turkey, moving missile systems into places like Romania, demonstrates a direct threat to Russian security. If we continue to alienate the Russians have been acting in a lot of ways, they've been acting in conjunction with the Chinese. They have held a lot of joint drills. They have set up joint operation centers. If a war were to erupt with Russia and China were to decide it wanted to seize the Pacific, we cannot, militarily, we cannot fight a war against those two superpowers. And right now, the Chief of Staff of the Army, General Mike Milley, said that the United States is militarily incapable of fighting a superpower struggle against one superpower, let alone if we were to end up going to blows between the Russians and the Chinese. We are setting ourselves up for an avoidable disaster.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to the In Context War Report on WPKN, 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host. I'm joined by Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and we've most recently been talking about the confrontation between the United States and China and North Korea in the Pacific and its effect upon our allies like South Korea and Japan. The In Context War Report is broadcast on the fourth Monday of the month from noon to one. Our website is incontextreport.com. Marshawn, I'd like to conclude the show with a short discussion of a subject which we should go into in greater detail at another show, and that is the unconventional means of waging war. This would include things like propaganda and deception. And a recent example occurred in Scandinavia when Swedish officials suspected that Russia is conducting a disinformation campaign by planting false stories in Sweden's media to encourage Swedes to oppose a proposed military partnership between the Swedes and NATO. These stories, for example, will suggest that NATO will create secret stockpiles of nuclear weapons in the country. So I'd like to mention, if we could, Marchand, a few examples of unconventional warfare, starting with deception, and perhaps the oldest example that I can think of is the Trojan horse. Could you talk a little bit about that?
The Trojan horse is one of the best examples of deception. I mean, as I'm sure as many of our listeners are familiar with the story of Helen of Troy, the Greeks traveling to Troy to try to avenge their honor and rescue Helen and all the rest of it. During the siege, the Greeks realized they couldn't penetrate the walls. It was just this bloody back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and it wasn't going to end. And the Greeks felt that, well, we can't break down the walls, we can't scale the walls, and we can't penetrate the Trojan defenses. We've been trying to, but we can't. So what options are left? Well, we can leave, in which case all this bloodshed and we can accomplish nothing, or we can try to deceive the Trojans. And so what they did is they established this giant wooden horse, and they hid elite Greek soldiers inside. And the idea was that the Trojans would, you know, they'd see the horse as an offering, bring it inside the walls, and, of course, go to sleep. As lunatic as the idea sounds on the outside, it actually made a lot of sense, because what the Greeks also did was they disassembled their camps, and they left. They made it appear as if, for all intents and purposes, they'd just given up. And this was kind of a peace offering, a way of saying, hey, you know, we give up. A practice that was very common in that time period, a way of saying, you know, we're sorry to have caused such a bother. The Trojans, of course, looked at this. They brought the horse into the city, and then, middle of the night, the Greek soldiers descended. And, of course, the Trojans were off their guard because they thought their enemy had left. They thought their enemy was gone. This is the origin, really, of deception in warfare, because then the Greeks descend, they open the gates, and their army floods in and sacks the city.
A more recent example of deception used in the combat situation was Operation Quicksilver in World War II involving George Patton. Could you talk about George Patton and his non-existent army?
Well, Operation Quicksilver was, again, a perfect example of deception, similar in a way to the deception used by the Greeks against the Trojans, evacuating the army so it looks like no one's there. In this case, it was almost the reverse. It was creating a fictitious army to make it look like the army really was there. And more importantly, they put Patton in charge of this army. Now, all of the German military analysts at the time, and this is where we interlock with modern military intelligence, you know, Patton was the most capable general in the Allied army. He was the most controversial, but he was also one of the most capable. Every German military analyst said that if anyone was going to lead the invasion of Europe, Eisenhower was going to put Patton in charge of it. Patton would be the spearhead. So, knowing that the Germans would come to this conclusion, Eisenhower put Patton in charge of this fictitious army. A severe blow to Patton's ego, but this fictitious army consisted of inflatable tanks, inflatable trucks. You had some poor guys who actually had to go around with what were basically tank treads and make marks in the dirt so it would appear to German surveillance aircraft that tanks were being moved around, and that this was where the invasion army was actually stationed. And then, of course, it was situated opposite Calais, because that also played into the German idea that the Allied invasion was going to come at Calais in France, because it was the narrowest point at the English Channel. So they automatically played into the German assumption that Patton would lead the attack, and then also played into the German assumption that they would choose the narrowest point in the channel. And by doing this, the deception was highly effective, and the Germans did not see the invasion at Normandy coming.
Now, Marchand, another example of unconventional warfare is disinformation. Could you talk about the Gleiwitz incident in Germany in 1939?
Absolutely. Well, the Gleiwitz incident was utilized by the Germans as the excuse for invading Poland. Now, granted, all of this had been prearranged by what was known as the secret protocol, which was an agreement between Stalin and Hitler that they would both invade Poland and they split the country in half and everybody would get their share. It was part of the Axis-Soviet Pact, also known as the Ribbentrop Pact. And so, but the Germans, of course, had to have a reason, Kos Belli, to invade Poland. So what they did, there was a small German radio station, a small military outpost on the border in this this German town, and the German army opens fire on the post. They said it was a Polish army. It turns out it was actually a German army, opened fire on the post, handful of German soldiers. And they left bodies dressed in Polish military uniforms nearby, because, of course, there was an exchange of fire, and all these Polish, dead Polish soldiers turn up. It appears, again, that they were most likely concentration camp victims who had been executed earlier, and their bodies had been dumped in Polish uniforms. At the end of the day, it was a masterful art of disinformation. What did the photographers see? The photographers who showed up on scene saw a radio station riddled with bullets, and they saw a whole bunch of dead bodies, and they photographed it all within the German newspapers. So Germany had unquestioningly been attacked by Poland. As illogical as it seems, because Poland was dwarfed by Germany militarily, as irrational as it seems, it was, all the evidence was there. And so it was a masterful art of deception.
Now, another form of unconventional warfare is propaganda. And one of the masters of propaganda, in fact, one of the masters of guerrilla warfare, was Mao, whose 1937 book on guerrilla warfare was the first systematic study of this form of war and remains the definitive guide. What forms of propaganda did he use to build his movement?
So we've talked about use of deception. We've talked about the use of disinformation. Mao utilized psychological warfare, but psychological warfare in the form of positive information, if you will. One of his standing orders was that wherever his People's Liberation Army traveled, they would never billet themselves in the local homes, the homes of villagers and farmers, without permission. Everything would be paid for. Any food they got would be paid for. He famously said that if you take a door, you will replace it. Soldiers would frequently sleep on the doors of houses. They'd remove the door and they'd sleep on that. Mao knew that the disinformation that would be coming from the nationalists was that the communists were just a bunch of bandits, a bunch of guerrillas in the mountains. Well, by putting his men into a military uniform, by having them behave, as it were, as professional soldiers, it gave a very professional image that this is a real army. This isn't just a bunch of Viet Cong hiding in the jungle kind of a thing, you know? And in a way, it creates the idea of a real, legitimate government. And that's one of the reasons why Mao also said that ideological training was just as important as military training.
And yet another form of unconventional warfare really has to do with battlefield tactics. Could you talk about the Boer War, which occurred in South Africa, 1899 to 1902, and the use of unconventional tactics in fighting by the Boers against the English?
The Boers are, for our listeners who don't know, they are the European population of South Africa, predominantly of Dutch descent, predominantly farmers. They have their own language, which is hybrid of English, Dutch, and German, and their own identity. And when the British came in and began, they took control of the Cape Colony and they began expanding into the interior of South Africa, the Boers, who ran their own affairs, who they had their own independent states, the Transvaal Republic and the Orange Free State, began to feel threatened. So they went to war with Britain. And initially, the Boers fought in several pitched battles with the British, battles at Colenso and Majuba Hill. While they bloodied the British very badly, the Boers realized very quickly that they could not go toe-to-toe with the far technologically superior British army. So tactics that were pioneered by men like Christian de Wet and Koos de la Rij was the idea of guerrilla war. And the idea of the commando, which is where we get our English word commando from, comes from the Boer commandos. Now, the Boer commandos were groups of somewhere anywhere between 12 and 2,000 men. Some commandos were very small, but some commandos were very large. They were on horseback. They were mounted. They would go out and harass the British troops. They would strike and then retreat. They would strike and then retreat. So they would go and they'd blow up rail lines. They'd go and they'd strike British supply posts. It was known as the War on the Veldt. Took so much of a toll on the British force that Lord Kitchener, who was put in charge of British forces in South Africa, had to resort to what was known as a scorched earth policy. He couldn't defeat the guerrillas in open battle. He couldn't surround them. So what he would do is he'd go through and he burned all the farms. because he knew the guerrillas subsisted off of the farms. And the Boers were not an urban population. What Lord Kitchener ultimately had to do was throw all of their families into concentration camps. The first concentration camps that we know of were built, sadly, by the British during the Boer War. And by burning all the farms, basically they starved the guerrillas out. And it's a very dark period in British history, but what it demonstrates was that the guerrilla tactics of the Boers, the harassing tactics, the fast-moving mounted units of the Boer commandos were so effective that literally the only way to defeat them was to starve them out and burn all their homes down.
Well, thank you very much for that analysis, Marchand. I'm afraid that's it for this edition of the In Context War Report. The In Context War Report is produced by MDR Productions, Inc. and is broadcast from noon to 1 on the fourth Monday of the month on WPKN 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming at WPKN.org. You can download the War Report from our website, incontextreport.com, or from WPKN.org by clicking on Podcasts in the upper left-hand corner. You can write to us at incontext@wpkn.org. On behalf of In Context Military Affairs commentator Marchand McDermott-Rowe, this is your host, Ken McDermott-Rowe. Thanks for listening. See you next time.